Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Jeanette Abney, and I want to thank you for joining me here at another exciting episode here at Precious Predicaments at Blog Talk Radio. I first want to say please excuse my noise because I got stuck with babysitting duty. So if you hear Sesame Street or Handy Mandy, whatever in the background, just please forgive me for that one. So, again, I want to start off because I'm all discombobulated, but I want to thank my Heavenly Father for waking me up this morning, and I want to thank Ryder, and I hope Ryder is going to be good as he eats his peanut butter and jelly sandwich while I'm on the air. So today's topic has to do with justice for all. Now, when it comes to the criminal justice system, many individuals lack the understanding and resources that is needed when we talk about if an individual was treated fairly by the system that we were once told to trust. Now, is the system always fair or is it just? Do individuals normally get what they deserve when it comes to sentencing? And I indicated you don't do the crime if you can't do the time. Because part of this is not to tell anyone or try to get any individuals from out of jail, but it's also basically to educate individuals so you won't get caught up in the system. Now, the United States is the world's leader when it comes to incarceration. When I was doing my research, I found that one in every black men in their 30s are sent to prison or jail any given day. And when you talk about the American Indian youth, they are three times as likely than white youth to be held in juvenile hall. We understand that there's an unequal sentencing for blacks and whites. There is also evidence of racial disparity in sentencing. There have been concerns about individuals basically doing the same crime yet receiving different punishments. So I'm glad you're here today, as I want you to join me, join me and Attorney Brandy Duvall as we discuss, educate, provide resources, and the best options to stay out of the system, because we do know a lot of times that innocent people do go to jail. So let me bring on my special guest. Hello. Hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Brandy. I appreciate you. And it's crazy because when Ryder called me on the phone, because I can't have my headphones on, the first thing he did was pick up the phone too. So we
That's
go,
what they
we
do.
Where we're going to hope he cooperates. So to the listeners out there, I want to introduce you to Attorney Brandy Duvall. Brandy Duvall is an attorney in the Long Beach area. And I want you to know, Brandy, I kind of went online and Googled your name just to see some stuff. And one of the things that I saw that I thought was very interesting, you were described as competent, caring, you know the law, and you stay on top of every challenging legal issues that are out there in regards to what's happening in our world. And I appreciate you for that. I truly do. Now, I'm going to log on some listeners, and I don't know who they are, but let me see because my lines are blowing up. But
okay.
And then we're going to start talking about this topic, okay?
All righty.
Hi, this is Jeanette Abney. Welcome to Precious Predicaments Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing? Okay, I guess they don't want to say anything. I got another call on here.
Hello?
Hi, this is Jeanette. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Jeanette?
I am well. I'm babysitting. I'm trying to watch a baby at the same time and be on the radio, so I'm trying to multitask. So you guys have to excuse me if I walk away because I might have peanut butter and jelly sandwich, peanut butter and jelly all over everything right about now. Okay.
We're going to let it do what it do.
Cause I really feel this is not fair.
funny. I just had a quick question.
Excuse me?
Oh, I just had a quick question.
Okay.
So that's got a lot of mixed information about the impact of legalizing marijuana, specifically for youth of color. Has the recent change been positive for youth of color?
Okay, you're talking about the recent change with the legalization of marijuana? Has it been
positive?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, Brandy, you want to answer that question? Because I can answer it from a perspective, because I'm also the owner of an outpatient drug and alcohol clinic. And when we're talking about the legalization on my end in regards to treatment, I'm finding that a lot of individuals were given misinformation. A lot of individuals do not understand the ramification, how they could still be arrested for under the influence, possession, and also in regards to children being born testing positive for a controlled substance. It doesn't mean that. And a lot of times I tell individuals all they wanted to do was to legalize the right to get high, because they're not using it for municipal purposes. They're using it because they want to be high. Now, Randy, I'm going to let you answer from a legal perspective in regards to answering this caller's question.
Okay, thank you. That's a really good question. And I remember right before, it was Prop 64, right before it passed in this November election, there were people that were really confused. People on the left, advocates, activists were split. On the one hand, just to talk about some of the positives that have come out of it, of course, we'll see, you know, I always feel like if somebody has a problem or they make a choice or whatever it is, it has to do with drugs, criminalization is not necessarily the way to go. And so from that perspective, it's a positive, because you have basically those over 21 are allowed to legally engage in a recreational use. That's totally separate from driving under the influence and all of that. And this is really something that's going to come into play when you have people who are usually stopped for something else. The police don't necessarily have anything to stick on them, and so they'll give them a citation or even something that could equate to a misdemeanor. And in one case, I've even had somebody who had a prior record who was struck out, meaning he was given a third strike because he was in possession of marijuana. So that won't be an issue. Now, for those who are between 18 and 20, of course, it's still not legal. Folks don't know that. And they just think, whoopee, I can run out and get high. So that's a problem. I think there is a much bigger issue, and it is the way that marijuana, lots of things, but specifically marijuana, is used as a pretext and a way to criminalize our youth. And so what we expect to see is for those who are between the ages of 18 and 20 who don't have medical marijuana cards, we're expecting to see an increase in their arrest rate.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It's really sad, because it's going to have a domino effect, of course, because that's the age when kids are applying to college. And so that's one of the questions on the college application, so that's going to be a big issue.
Right.
From the business side, and this was one of my problems that I had when this law was on the books, if you have a prior conviction under this new law, you can go ahead and get that reduced or expunged, so taken off of your record or reduced, depending on what the charge is, but you'll be prohibited from working in the industry. So there's going to be a lot of money made, but it's not going to help communities of color. So it's a mixed bag. I hope I answered your question.
You did.
Okay. Well, you know what?
Thank
you did
so
an awesome job with that, because there is a lot of miscommunication when it comes to that. I have another caller on the line. Let me log this caller on.
Okay. Thank the both of you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio here at Precious Predicaments. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay.
And you?
Do you have any questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Okay.
I noticed you were talking about expunging records. Do you think that a senior citizen, 73 years old of age, that has a record that's 20-something years old for drugs should have it expunged?
Well, I mean, I think depending on the nature of the charge, that individual would be able to. It depends on when it comes to, well, a couple of things. First of all, I believe it's UCLA, and I also think it's the Church Fame. They have or had expungement clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the public defender, your local public defender, you can look them up online or call, or if you feel so inclined, go on down to the office. They have resources about expungement. So that's that.
You know what, Brandy? I want to chime in on that question.
Okay.
And even though
could
therapist,
I ask you a question?
I've always Let me say this. I want to say also to the caller who asked that question, it also depends also if you have other criminal activities, because an expungement is supposed to be for employment purposes only. And what happens is it's still on your record. However, an employer cannot use it against you. And in some cases, individuals in the state of California was getting their charges reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor under 1202.3 of the Penal Code, and then they were having it later expunged. So, Jesus, grab him before you walk out that thing. I'm sorry for screaming. She showed back up. Thank you, Jesus. Okay. So, with that being said, if you're running into situations of the senior where you're having problems with getting your Social Security, because I've seen individuals' Social Security be denied or they run into certain situations because of criminal activities, then you might want to go back and have that record expunged. Does that
help? Okay. Yes, it does. And would you possibly be able to send a copy of this to your father in Georgia?
I knew that's who that was.
Would you possibly be able to send a copy? Because you're mentioning California, places like UCLA, could you possibly send a printout of this to your father in Georgia?
Yes, I would, but what I would have to do is get your case history, and what you do is you file a petition for expungement, and normally what happens is after 6 weeks, the individual will go to court, and the judge, if they haven't had any other priors or they're not on probation or parole, the judge will normally expunge those cases. So I've seen it happen in a lot of situations.
Because my drug case is 20-something years old. And,
is the record here in California or is it in Georgia? Where is the crime?
The record is in California.
There's another process.
Well, it started in Alabama, but it ended in California.
You just went across the whole country, huh?
Oh, girl,
it
you don't
like
want to know,
Brad. It seems like that.
There's another process, and it's been in the news, and it's, depending on how much effort you want to put into it, but it's not too difficult. Brown's been granting a lot of expungements, actually a pardon. With a case like yours, you might be able to do that. What he'll do is you'll file this application for clemency, pardon, and then he'll kick it over to the DA. The DA will basically have you file a certificate of rehabilitation, and it pretty much will take care of it. So it'll be when you go through Jerry Brown, he'll kick it back to the courts. So you'll get it from the governor's side and the court side if it's that old.
That's
beautiful. You know
old. It was in 1995.
You should be
log on
this
other
woman.
I beg your pardon?
No, I said, let me log on this other caller because they've been holding on hold for 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, you try to get that to your father whenever possible.
I
thank you. You have a blessed day.
Thank you. Hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Pricey Predicaments at Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
Nick McNeil.
Hello, Nick. How are you doing? I got so many callers on this line. It's crazy. I got another caller, Nick. Hold on.
Carry on.
You can ask whatever question. Yeah. Hold on for 1 second.
No questions. Carry on.
Gotcha. Hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Pricey Predicaments. How are you doing? Area code 773. Okay, they're still on. And I want to let you guys know, if you're on and you don't really have any questions or you don't want to talk, you can also, I don't know if you can listen in a listen mode, then that way it won't be on the switchboard. or if you click on your Facebook link that I sent you, you can also listen that way. So there are several different ways that you can listen to the live show that we have going on here. And I want to thank again Brandy Duvall for joining us here, who is an attorney in the California area. Now, I indicated in regards to the United States being one of the world's largest leader in incarceration, and there are approximately 2.2 million individuals in the nation's prisons and jails. There's also been a 500% increase in individuals going to jail or prison in the last or over the last 40 years. Now, there have been changes made to laws and policies. However, such is not helping the crime rate. You know, we came up with the three strikes law and things of that nature. Now, the more what's happening is we're finding that more individuals are being sent to jail and prison at an enormous rate. Such is creating a mass incarceration, which, however, has not impacted all communities equally. Now, Brandy, I want you to share a little bit about that because I want to first give them some insight. And I know people are hearing me become very passionate because I tell individuals when I do my therapy, I never said I wanted to be a therapist. I always wanted to be an attorney and then retire as a judge because law has always been my passion. So I don't want to take over with this, Brandy, because you are the expert. But in regards to the criminal justice system, I want you to explain to them how the criminal justice system, when we talk about the practice and the institution of government that are directed and for upholding social control, deterring and mitigating crimes, are sanctioned to those who violate the law and criminal penalties and rehabilitative efforts. Now, my question is, when we talk about that system, where are you finding that we can do some changes or do some things? We talk about laws and policies in America when it comes to our criminal justice system.
Well, one of the things that I see is that we may not even fully be aware of this, but for those of us who exercise our right to vote, we vote for these judges.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you really stop and think about it or you follow an individual's career, you'll see that 85% just about of all judges are former prosecutors. So,
mm-hmm.
I read a statistic somewhere that even during his first batch of federal judges that Obama sought to have appointed, only 15%,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, pretty high because you can have a prosecutor, a defense attorney, or a civil attorney, okay? So only 15%
mm-hmm.
of the judges that Obama appointed that first go-round were defense attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went back and started work to rectify that, of course, because it was Obama. So ultimately he did the right thing. But
wow.
The point
mm-hmm.
that I'm trying to make is that you're asking someone whose entire career orientation has been to lock people up. And suddenly you
mm-hmm.
think that all of that career, all of that history, all of that orientation disappears because they put on a robe. It's not so. So one of the things that we should do, and I have talked to people about this, and especially this last, the last local election that we had, I asked people, who did you vote for this or that judge? And a lot of times we don't do the research. We don't think about it. There's so many other things that we're going to vote for that we sort of become passive in this aspect, either we don't choose a judge or we don't pay attention and just check off. Or I had a friend who just said, I just voted for all the women. And
wow.
Sometimes, yeah, and sometimes, you know, that can hurt us. Especially when we see on their career prosecutor or gang prosecutor, that may not necessarily be in our own best interest. So I think that's a really big thing that I just can't stress enough. Another,
mm-hmm.
pardon me?
No, go on and finish what you were going to say.
Oh, sure. I was going to say another thing that we can do is, have done a lot of work with lifers, so individuals who have been
mm-hmm.
sentenced and they have to work their way out of prison. They don't have a set release date. And one of the things that I've come to learn through this process is in California, certain cases have to get by the governor. So in this process, I get to work with a lot of district attorneys. We're sort of on opposite sides of the issue, but you have a lot of contact because the parole process isn't very formal. You're working with the governor's office. You get to see this from different sides. And one thing I see is that victims' rights groups who often will oppose parole are very organized.
Mm-hmm.
They have a strong lobby, and we just don't. Now, because victims' rights groups are organized and they do have money and they do get, you know, different support from police organizations or law enforcement in general, you know, it, sometimes it seems like they're so big there's nothing that we can do. But as more and more of us have our lives touched by the criminal justice system or know, you know, someone that we love who's been a part of this criminal justice system, we can see that the umbrellas is sort of getting bigger and bigger. And so because there's strength in numbers, if you find that you have an interest in this, you know someone in prison, there's different groups. One of them is Life for Support Alliance. They're really good. That group was started by a woman whose husband was a lifer. He's out now. There's another great group, Uncommon Law, Prison Law Office. They need volunteers. They need $5 donations. Sometimes they just need bodies to show up if they're going to do a protest. So there's things like that that we can do, and it also it's an opportunity for us to gather information. Uncommon Law does symposiums and things, and a Life for Support Alliance has a newsletter. So these are all things we can do to build strength and numbers and to come together to create change in the system. And then educate yourself and know which judges you're voting for. It's a really big thing.
And, you know, and I want to thank you for sharing that information, because a lot of times people don't realize that. I didn't realize it when I was younger in regards to the politics that are also involved in the criminal justice system. So I guess God had a plan for my life to say, you know what, Jeanette, maybe you don't need to be an attorney. Maybe you should have just became a therapist. But I'm very glad that I'm acclimated in so many different areas. Like I tell them, I'm not an attorney, but because it always came natural to me. Now, when you talk about the criminal justice system, it is a set of agencies that Brandy basically indicated, and it possesses an established government to control, like I said, those different things. But I want to give you some information in regards to the three main parts. Part one is law enforcement. A lot of times individuals always and automatically connect the police or law enforcement to the judges and the courts. But they are one part, which is law enforcement, which consists of police, sheriff, and marshals. Then you have part two, which is the adjudication, which are the courts, which includes the judges, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys. And I like how you was explaining to them, Brandy, in regards to the difference between a public defender and alternate defender. Sometimes you can get a state-appointed attorney, because sometimes there may have been a conflict of interest, especially if there's two different defendants on the same case and they can't use the same office. And also we got part three, which is the corrections, which is the prison officials, probation officers, and parole officers. So they are what makes up the three main parts. Now, when we start talking about the process, a lot of times individuals don't even understand the different steps. And when I said don't do the crime if you can't do the time, I have a co-therapist. She always tell me when I get mad about something, she'd be like, Jeanette, you know we ain't got no bail money. You know we don't have no bail money. So we always get a pinch, and we feel that, you know, individuals that are indigent, individuals that are low income always get the butt end of the deal because they don't have the money to fight their cases. And how the first caller was calling, talking about the issue with marijuana and the marijuana laws, which are getting totally out of control. And then me being the owner of an outpatient counseling center, I do the 52-week batters intervention program, which also consists of the child abuse program. And individuals really need to start educating themselves in regards to those penal codes, because people and families are being broken up behind domestic violence. And the month of October is the National Domestic Violence Awareness. So there's a lot of things going on people don't understand. And also children that are witnessing domestic violence, child protective services are getting involved, and people are losing custody of their kids behind that because they didn't know that, nor did they know that driving and while under the influence of a controlled substance with your kids in the car, meaning if you are a pot smoker and you picking your child up from a soccer game and you under the influence of marijuana, yeah, you got a CPS case. So these are things where individuals need to become more informed. Now, when we're talking about the steps in the criminal justice process, the major step in processing a criminal case are as follows. There's an investigation or the police are called. There's an arrest made by the police. An arrest involving taking a person into custody for the purpose of holding the suspect sometime until court. Sometimes people bail out. Sometimes they cannot afford bail. Now, after they finish that, what would you say is the next step? Can you explain to our listeners what happens after an arrest, Randy?
Yes, I can. And I also wanted to say, just touch on one quick little thing. This, because sometimes I just wish I could just, like, get a little box and stand on the corner and just give out a few legal tips because I see so many unnecessary things happen. And one of them is a lot of people don't, for reasons unbeknownst to me, they don't have a marijuana card. If you decide that this is what you're going to do, you really should look into getting a marijuana card. It'll make your life a lot easier. Despite the benefits that I talked about to Proposition 37 of the marijuana law, having the card would help you out. So that's just that. As far as the process goes, you know, you're not having your best day or your best week or your best month, right? If you're in this process, if you're in the criminal justice process, you've been booked. You're going to court. So your first hearings are going to be like a bail hearing or see if you can be released, and it's at that point that you're going to meet your public defender. And I really want to get into talking about how to work with the public defender, but I'll put a pin in that. So there's that early process. You go to court. You're going to have a bail hearing. You're going to go see the judge. You're going to find out what you're charged with. And very soon thereafter, you're going to plead guilty or not guilty and no contest. So you're going to have your arraignment. And then you have a series of hearings after that that are just called essentially your pretrial hearings. And somewhere in there you're going to get a preliminary hearing where you're going to find out the gist of what the state has to use against you. A lot of times people are very surprised to learn that certain types of crimes, certain types of battery or domestic violence crimes, you don't even need the victim to testify against you. That's a really big one. Folks are shocked. So sometimes they spend a lot of time trying to, quote, get the victim not to come forward. It ain't going to do you no good, especially in Long Beach. Long Beach was one of the first counties that really pushed this notion of, you know, protecting domestic violence victims and not putting the onus on them to come forward and testify and live in fear. Another thing that the law enforcement will do, they will go so far as to prosecute an individual for not coming to court to testify against you. So believe it or not, people will, I have a case recently where these two individuals had a certain, let's call it negative exchange. My client wound up in court getting prosecuted for assault, and the victim said, I'm not going to go to court. And so guess what? The police went and picked him right up, and they brought him right to court, and he did. He had no choice. So those are just some things to be wary of. At some point, your attorney, and again, we're talking about folks that don't have a tremendous amount of financial resources. So your public defender is going to come to you and talk to you about any potential deals or offers or pleas. You'll decide whether or not to accept the deal. There was a great piece, and I think it was in the LA Times, about how our system is such that the system counts on you to take a deal. If no one took another deal, the system would be bombarded and overwhelmed. We're not equipped for all of these folks to go to trial. But what happens is you panic and you look at all the time that you could be facing, and if you're feeling like your public defender isn't particularly well organized, you don't have a lot of faith in them, or you know you did it, you may take a plea. And if you do take a plea, things aren't over for you because chances are you're going to have to comply with conditions of probation. And typically that, you know, even for a misdemeanor, that's going to last you 2 to 3 years. Or you can go the other way and go to trial and see where you get with that. So that's the basic gist of the process. And quite often, from the time that you're arrested until this matter is complete, whether you take a plea or not, you're looking at a minimum of 2 to 3 years. Because even if you plead out early, you're going to have to do your probation. So once you start, and that's my big advice to people, and it sounds silly, but I'm dead serious.
Don't get involved. Hold that thought, Brendan. Let me add this caller, and then I'm going to say something. We're going to go back. We got another caller on the line. Hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Precious Predicaments Blog Talk Radio. Sorry for the hold. How are you doing? Someone just called last four number 0611. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Do you have a question?
I do have a question. It's not on the subject of the marijuana that you guys were talking about. I have a question in regards to, I have a 15-year-old relative who was convicted at 15 with robbery or murder under the commission of robbery. And he was sentenced to 51 years to life at 15 years old. And at this point, he's 31 years old. And I believe he was denied his last parole hearing. They waited actually until he was about 16 or 17 to really start his process. And he really matured during that phase. And I think that because of where it was used against him. And so he was, charged as an adult, and he had no prior issues. Well, he had some juvenile issues, but no prior serious convictions.
Gotcha. One of the things, I remember seeing a documentary in regards to another situation where a person was had committed a robbery, and it was him and some older gentlemen. And because of that, once he matured, had not got any problems in the jail, a good person in the jail, no write-ups, no nothing. And what he had to do was he had to utilize his court system. That's where you need a strong support system to start writing letters, to see if you can get him resentenced, to see. And sometimes, because a lot of times people don't like touching those cases, but if you keep writing, he keeps demonstrating that he has rehabilitated himself. One of the things that I found, and like Brandy was saying, the system can become so bombarded, but you have to stay, be an advocate, and basically continue to write letters, take it up to the United States Supreme Court, or whatever you have to do in order to get this person's case heard. And even if they deny him the first time, keep coming back. Because I used to tell my mother, I don't like being told no. I'll just keep on until somebody go hear me out. Brandy, what do you have to say in regards to that?
Yes. So, first of all, that's very sad, and it kind of it really does bring into play some of the issues that you talked about during the introduction, where you're seeing, I mean, I don't know the race or ethnicity of this young man, but you're seeing a lot of harsher sentences for youths of color. I read some statistics. The ACLU has a great link on their website about racial disparities in sentencing, and we see those play out even for young people. There was a New York Times article that said that 99% of all of the young people handcuffed at school are either black or Latino. 99%. So I think that's a staggering statistic, and it's not a surprise then that we see these kids go on to be prosecuted at higher rates than their white counterparts. And I will tell you that in the state of California, there is some hope out there. Unfortunately, the racial disparity piece of it is very sad, but as a matter of just strict black letter law, there were two recent changes. SB 260 and SB 261. And essentially what these provisions do is SB 260 gives those who were under the age of 18 when they committed their crime an opportunity to go to the parole board at either 15, 20, or 25 years. It just depends on how, you know, what they were sentenced to. The prison does a calculation. And then SB 261 took it a step further and applied the same principle to folks who are under the age of 23 when they committed their crimes. So your relative will not have to do the 51 years before he gets a shot at parole. That's the good news. One of the problems that I see with my clients is the light doesn't come. Now, she said that he matured a lot during his first year of incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of these people, the light doesn't come on. And we could do, I could do a whole other show on what it takes to get ready for parole and all that. But these young people need to know that as soon as they hit the door, they need to start programming, stay away from violence. There's a way to do it because I see people do it. I just had a hearing last week for a young man who was 20 when he went into prison. He's never had a prison write-up. It was his first hearing. It was an SB 261 hearing. He was found suitable for a parole, so he'll be coming home. So it's possible.
So
you know
what?
And I want to say,
What advice do you give to what advice should I give to him in speaking to him about avoiding these troubles? You know, there's a lot of times. Because of the time, everybody wants to be socially connected, and it's rampant everywhere, and it leads to a lot of problems, and it also, if you get written up for it, you have a problem. And so you have an infraction on your record. And I want to support him in the best way possible so that he can reach the goal of leaving from those prison bars. And
one of the things, I'm sorry to cut you off, but one of the things is, she, the lawyer indicated is getting into program, doing the time. And I want to say, I remember with my husband, we met when we were 14 years old. He got caught up in a crime for a crime that he didn't commit and was, it took me a long time to even find him in jail. But when I did find him, my mother then was trying to tell me that he was dead and they didn't want me to know, which I had nothing to do with what he got in trouble for. But he served 25 years for a crime that he didn't commit. And doing that time was hard. So every time he would try to go up for parole, they would deny it. He would write these letters. He would, and they was judging him. But he was 22 when he went in, and didn't get out to 25 years later. And then at 20 years, he had a 20-some-year-old warrant where they knew where he was, and then had to go serve another 5 years. So I would just say for him not to get discouraged, hang around more positive people that are doing their time in a productive way, stay away from some of that prison politics, then that will be his ticket for freedom, and keep his mind strong. Because what you don't want him to do is become institutionalized or develop a lot of hate, because that hate is not going to get him anywhere. Because a lot of that, like I said, with the jail politics, the racism, you think racism is bad on the outside, racism is worse on the inside. And then we got kids that are biracial going into custody, and they don't know which side of the fence to be on. It's a mess. But some of the programs are being taken out of the prisons when we talk about rehabilitation. And then what happens is when a person get out, they're still being judged. It's like when my father was calling saying, what do you do if you have a case from 1970-something? Because that stuff still comes back and haunts you. Because you did that time, and then society still treats you like a criminal when you get out, whether you was a model citizen or not. It's like we're talking about O.J. Simpson or a lot of other people that have committed crimes. Some people get out, don't know what to do when they're out, and go right back in, and some individuals are able to function well in society. But just tell him, stay strong, keep his head up, and stay out of trouble. And, you know, a lot of times people deal with the guilt. They go in there and they beat themselves up. It's just a lot. But I want to say, and I want to reiterate, when we're talking about the steps, they have a process which they talk about 15 steps. What happened, like I said, people get arrested. Then you got an investigation or sometimes just the arrest and then the custody. They're charged. You got the preliminary hearing. And in some cases, Brandy, we got what's called a grand jury, depending on the crime. You got an arraignment. a bail detention hearing. Plea bargaining starts. And we can go back and forth with the plea bargaining because a lot of times people plea and take deals that they really don't have to take. And that
right.
was one of the things that you were saying is sometimes you can weigh them out because the longer you fight, and sometimes people say taking it to the box. They say that that's an old prison term. They know that somebody or you got jailhouse lawyers and things of that nature come up taking it to the box. Then you got the trial of the adjudication. You got the sentencing or disposition. If you take a deal, then you took that deal. But if you
right.
plea it out and you found guilty, then you have the chance to file an appeal or there are what's called post-conviction remedies. And when you're in custody, then you got something, you got a leg to stand on. You can write your writ of habeas corpus if you're in California or whatever state you're in. You follow your appeal process. Now, talking about taking these deals, Brandy, let's talk a little bit about that because a lot of times people are scared. They don't want to go to jail or, you know, the first deal come their way or they'll go in. And I've had clients tell me that they knew they did what they did, so when they first went in, they pled guilty. And I said, well, why would you do that? Even if the person knew they're guilty, they say not guilty, just to hear it out. What is your advice in regards to people going in automatically talking about I'm guilty?
It depends. I had a case where these guys beat this man up and they beat the man to death. That's a short version. And everybody took a deal except for him because he felt that he didn't wield the final blow. And they, he was offered 8 years. And I say in about 20-25% of my cases, you have somebody who is offered a flat term, and they take it to trial. And maybe that first trial will result in a hung jury. But either the first or second trial, they get convicted, and they get convicted for a longer time. I think one of the things that is really important in this process, and people just don't know and they just don't do it enough, is for those of us who are fortunate enough to have family members, go to the hearings with your loved one. Even if they're incarcerated and it's hard to see them like that, go to court and make an appointment to talk to your loved one's public defenders. Public defenders get a very bad rap. For the most part, the public defenders that I know got into this because they really wanted to help. And what happens is they don't – it's supposed to be two sides of the same coin, right, the public defender and the DA. Well, we know, we talked earlier in the show, most judges are former district attorneys, so they already have some, you know, quote, camaraderie there, right? And the reason that you said earlier in the show that people kind of see them all together, the police, the judge, the public defender, well, if you go in there and sit and watch, you see they've take lunch breaks together. The police are sitting at the table with the district attorney. The police officers are the DA's witnesses and things like that. So it can get really overwhelming. Go talk to your public defender. See how you can support them. I've had so many people who have, you know, beat their case, if we'll use that language, and they were the ones that said, I told my public defender this was the person that's my witness. This is where to find them. You also can my godmother's a school teacher, and unfortunately she's been in the position to do this, you know, too many times. But write character letters. Go out and ask your pastor or so-and-so to write a supportive letter for your loved one. The other thing that you can do is when you get into, and my people, we get this so bad, we get mad and cuss the public defender out. Now, what's that going to do? No, you can't do that. You sit down, you talk to the public defender, and if you they're really not doing a good job, first of all, if you go to court and meet with them and conduct yourself appropriately, it'll speak volumes, and you'll get the best service from that person that you can. But, you know, if push comes to shove, you can tell them, you know, let's say this is your son. My son and I are not happy. We want to speak to your supervisor. Even that'll light a little fire underneath them. The public defender also has resources to secure the services of private investigators or expert witnesses. Ask those questions. And finally,
you know what I'm gonna do? What were you going to say for finally, and then I want to share something.
Oh, I was just going to say, finally, you'd be surprised. There are certain community organizations, or calling the ACLU, or calling Legal Aid, let them know, I'm trying to get this public defender to work for me. What can I do? You'll find a lawyer there who will talk to you for free and kind of help you navigate the navigation of the process, if that makes sense. Help you help yourself.
Yeah. And you know what, Brandy, I want to say this, because people call them public pretenders and all of that. I tell them this. I would go and sit in the courtroom and I watch people. I watch who's connected with who. Because a public defender, they get a check. Most hired attorneys, you are the check. So sometimes even hiring an attorney may not always work in your best interest, because I've seen attorneys walk into courtrooms and counties where it becomes territorial. Where with that public defender, he has a relationship already with the judge, with the DA, and you can talk to them, and they're going to treat you sometimes accordingly on the way you treat them. If you're nice to them,
you respect them,
they will go to bat for you. But if you come off like you ain't got no job, they still have a law degree. And then you go get what you got coming to you. So you got to learn how to respect individuals. So I want to say that, like I said, at least they do get a check. They're not out there ambulance chasing, hustling, trying to make some money.
Right.
Because I've seen individuals lose big cases even with an attorney. I got another call coming in. Give me 1 second. Hi, this is Jeanette Abney. Welcome to Precious Predicaments Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. Do you have a question or is it something you want to share?
Yes, I do have a question for your guest today, and I just wanted to know, do you ever encounter or have encountered discrimination as a professional?
That's a good question. I have. I mean, I don't think it would be a surprise. One of the biggest things that my girlfriend and I, African-American attorney as well, talk about is how when we go to court, we could be anything but the lawyer. We could be the probation officer. We could be the defendant. We could be lost, certainly in the wrong department. But even it's to the point where, you know, when you go to court, you go and you will check in. And I've had people say, what are you doing here? Well, fool, I'm in a suit with a briefcase. I'm here to try the case. I mean, what do you think I'm doing here? So that's part of it, right? But, you know, that I can shake off. I think one of the things that has probably been the biggest surprise to me is how much gender discrimination I would face. Mm. Sometimes hard to separate the two. But I went to court once, and just by chance, there was a black male attorney that I went to law school with, and the way that he was treated was totally different from the way that I was treated. I mean, I got the same thing, kind of like, what are you doing there? Called his case before mine, just the whole gamut. So that's been sort of a big surprise for me.
And you know what? And this is the thing, too, and I can hear it in your voice, even with my first conversation with you, Brandy, is you are very articulate, and you understand when you run into that, how to deal with it. You never underestimate a person. I remember my daughter told me, even as being an owner of an outpatient drug and alcohol program, my daughter said, Mom, you have to stop making people look stupid. And it's not that I do it on purpose. It's not that I do it on purpose, but I have a very strong personality. And, you know, even if I don't know, you ain't going to know I don't know it. Because I know I have the gift to gab for that, and especially even in a courtroom. Because I've been in situations where I've had attorneys literally just sell me out, and I had to represent myself in one of my cases. When they say a client that has an attorney basically for himself has a fool for an attorney. But I feel as long as I kept my emotions out of it, as long as I kept it based on the facts and I used what they was using against me for me, I won my cases every single time. But they thought I was a baby Johnny Cochran. They didn't know. They was like, who is doing all of this? Give me a little time. I'm going to figure it out. Girl, I will write my depositions. I will write my out. Girl, I done had in Orange County. I'll be writing letters to county council. They'd be like, we don't want to talk to her.
You're one of those people, they wish you would get a lawyer. I meet people like that.
Girl,
they're like, thank goodness, I couldn't be.
You know what? I'm going to tell you, it's so crazy, Till. I have my clients, they will call me before they call the attorneys. They'll be like, Jeanette, Miss Jeanette, because they knew that they could trust me because I was one who had nothing to gain, nothing to lose. But I always tell them, I am not your attorney. However, girl, then the attorneys start calling me, asking me questions. They be like, are you sure you're not an attorney? No, I'm a therapist, but I'm going to keep it like that.
But, you know, I appreciate clients like that because sometimes, you know, it's like you want clients to do their due diligence and help themselves. It makes it easier for you when you're about your business and you're taking care of things, too. It's easier to work together.
Mm-hmm. And that is true. That is so true because, then again, it goes back to respect. And like you said, even when you are in the courtroom, because I've seen a lot happen in courtrooms, but I've been in some courtrooms where the judges didn't even want me speaking in the courtroom. They'd be like, uh-uh, here comes Abby. I'll be sitting there like, I'll be good this time. Okay, I got a call from 714 area code. So let's see who this is. Give me 1 second. Hi,
okay,
this is Jeanette Abney. Welcome to Precious Predicaments Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing? Hello, this is Jeanette Abney.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, this is Jeanette. Do you have any questions or anything you want to share?
Yes, I have a question on 3 strikes. I'm from California, and my sister has 2 strikes, and she's always joking around. One of her friends is on a 3rd strike, and just my question is, has that been overturned?
That is a really good question. So there's been a couple of things. There was Prop 36. There was a the old Prop 36 was about probation instead of prison for certain drug users.
Mm-hmm.
The Prop 36 in 2012 was a revision to the 3 strikes law, and basically saying you could only be struck out when that third strike was serious or violent. So that was the first piece, because you had feedback from almost everywhere, people saying, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. You know, we've all heard the guy getting struck out for stealing a piece of pizza.
For the pizza.
Then there was Prop 57, and that was in this most recent go-round. Prop 57 was, it allowed parole for nonviolent felons. So, sometimes, like for example, I have a client who his 3rd strike was related to selling marijuana. So he's going to qualify for Prop 57. So it's sort of a 3 strike still does exist, which we never really needed it because you can get crazy enhancements for your second serious crime. I mean, you can California is so strict. You probably only get 1 strike. But having said that, it does still exist.
Correct.
But under Prop 57, if you have a nonviolent strikable offense, you'll have a chance. And they're putting together now, the public defenders and the DA and the prisons are working together to put together these, quote, Prop 57 panels. And as I understand it, it'll be something like the regular parole board, but these folks will be specifically there to hear this wave of Prop 57 cases. So people should start hearing relatively soon.
You know what, Brandy? I want to say this because I've sat in courtrooms and I've heard them strike a strike. I've also heard them talk about the Romero law, because Romero, where some, because people were getting their 3rd strikes, just like you said, for a drug charge, which could have been a misdemeanor, but because they had 2 priors, and now they've been struck out. So there are some things that are going and are taking place when you start talking about these strikes. And talking about, again, we were talking about having cases expunged because some individuals are having their drug charges expunged, which is they're finding, like I said, because they're being very helpful. But then when you start talking about these cases, they're becoming very interesting. And one of the things that I saw in California for the first time in my life is they – have that proposition where individuals were being released from prison, but not on parole, but was placed on probation because I used to attend those PAC meetings for parolees to acclimate them back into the community. One of the things I want to say is, for our loved ones, is we do need more community resources. We need more outreach programs. We need things to keep our youth involved so that they cannot be a part of the criminal justice system. We need to stop these racial profiling. We need to stop, in regards to our law enforcement officers, stop the discrimination between individuals and the police department. And I want to say, even as a therapist, that's where I do my part, because not only do I get to work with individuals that have been committed of a crime, I also get to provide therapy services to first responders, law enforcement, individuals that have EAP, because I get to try to help educate them to kind of breach this and break this discrimination, because it is getting out of control. We are so divided to it's becoming a problem. And not only that, there have been situations where people have sat on a bench, especially in Orange County, got arrested, and now you got to go through the loop right along with the criminals.
Yep.
And so we just want to be very, very mindful of who we mistreat. Now, we have 34 minutes left on the show. If you want to call in, you can call in at 516-387-1914. I like the feedback that we're getting, even though, Brandon, we didn't get a chance to touch on a lot of stuff. So this is going to be a two-part show, because there are organizations that we need to learn more about, like when we're talking about the ACLU, talking about the Life Support Alliances and Uncommon Law Office. So we're going to be sharing more information for people that got life sentences, because these jailhouses are full. Some people make it in, some people don't make it out. When you start talking about children and youth that are being charged as an adult for crimes, so educating and offering support for these families is one of the things that we wanted to do with this show. Now, Brandy, I found some information, and it talked about racial disparities. And it says, like I said, 1 in 10 black men in their 30s is in prison or jail on any given day. And American Indian youth are 3 times as likely as white to be held in juvenile detention facilities. But when you start talking about that, I saw that there was some legislation going on in South Carolina, and they must reform life without parole sentences. South Carolina has started this down road to criminal justice reform, which they said is a beginning, but a long road. They have a legislative package designed to accelerate the state's progress out to include consideration to reform long-term sentencing. Now, you spoke a little bit about that in California. Why do you think we have such a disparity when it comes to, like, an individual getting arrested for marijuana in regards to their time versus someone for cocaine or crack and cocaine? Because that's been a big issue here in the state of California.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that the nature of our system is such that crime is big business. And so one of the things that I was very surprised to learn, I took a public interest law school, a public interest law class when I was in law school, and I was really shocked to learn that police officers were engaging in a specific type of racial profiling wherein they were actually targeting youth of color primarily for purposes of arresting them for marijuana possession. One of the things that was actually being passively taught was that people who looked a certain way were more likely to be in possession of marijuana or to have it in their cars. And so in order to accomplish this goal, there was a green light given to stop and frisk youth of color. So there was some interesting research that came out, and I believe it was in the same ACLU study on racial disparities in sentencing, where they talked about the numbers of black and Latino youth that have been subject to stop and frisk versus white youth. And I think it's important to know that that was literally, actually by design and for the purpose of giving these young men, mostly men, citations, tickets for possession That was actually the goal. So one of the things that, of course, came out of that, as I said earlier, is this has a domino effect of making it so that these young people have delays or denials in getting into college. So that's part of it. And why was this done? Because if you are an officer that needs to show so many contacts or make so many arrests or, quote, have quotas, how are you going to do that? We've all seen officers at certain times of the month kind of sitting off to the side on the freeway. And I call it ticket day because you know that this is getting, you know, sometimes towards the end of the month. And so you see folks kind of waiting. And so it's all in that same vein. So I think it's we have a very punitive approach to problem solving in this country and especially in the state. And we see it play out time and again where we get the short end of the stick. The other thing, of course, is you have, I'll never forget I had, Brian
Springs.
Oh, Lord. Keep talking.
I'll never forget when I had a panel. When you do parole in California, the hearings are set by the parole hearings are set by county, and I had an LA County panel, and all of the surnames were Latino surnames, and I think it was five cases. All five of the cases were Latino males who were under the age of 25 when they committed their crimes, and each case had an aspect of it that involved some type of gang activity.
Wow.
Thought it was so sad because if I could see that, then it means that the problem was clear and there was a solution. And the cases were time and again, first or second generation. All of the individuals, the parents were at work when they were getting into this type of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So the writing was on the wall, and it just showed me that it was unnecessary for these lives and families to be so negatively impacted. But nothing was being done at the front end. And then when the kids got into trouble, what did? We locked them up. So
And, you know, and it's interesting you said that because we're finding, like I said, we do need more programs, more things for kids to do. And it reminded me when you said that, I remember I had a family member, and he was sharing how when he got arrested in Vegas, because Vegas is really big with marijuana. And he was sharing how when he was, you know, in court, the judge started calling out his charges and stuff and accused him of having possession of marijuana. He said he did the timeout sign, like, no, Your Honor, I did not have marijuana. It was cocaine. Because you would get more time for marijuana in Vegas than you would if you had cocaine. Then here we come with this opiate epidemic where, you know, before they were talking about individuals that were selling crack was basically more of the people were individuals that were, and it's not good, and I will never promote selling drugs in regards to selling drugs for financial gain. But you found that individuals that were minorities were selling crack, where the upscale, the high-making money was the cocaine. But they were getting less time, and then that was one of the big things that we saw. And then now here comes this opiate, where you got people addicted to heroin, you got people addicted to prescription pills, and their sentence is far less than individuals that are selling other things or some of the crimes that are being committed. Now, I'm looking at something, and they talk about it in the news, and it goes as far as September 29, 2017, state advocacy update. And it talks about they're getting ready for 2018. As 2018 approaches, advocates are ready. They have efforts on sentencing reforms and challenging racial disparity in a criminal justice system when it comes to sentencing and sentencing policies. Now, where do you see that going? Because they indicate that with the sentencing policy, half of the people in federal prisons are serving time for drug offense. And like I said, they started with the Prop 36, and I was part of, in 2001, I was part of the team with Orange County Healthcare Agency, where I did assessments and evaluations for nonviolent drug offenders. And I noticed that when individuals were coming in and being in, basically after they took their deal, they would take the deal because they did not want to go to jail. In most cases, it wasn't that they wanted to be clean. But then when the funding ended, I'm finding that we're running back into situations where people have been sentenced under Prop 36 more than one time. And then we have situations where they weren't all drug users. Some of them were drug dealers, but they knew that they would get less time being a user than they would being a dealer. Now, when you start talking about sentencing policy, they talk about things in regard to America. There is an increase in the use of lifelong term sentencing. They're finding that the impact of mandatory minimum penalties in federal prisons is some of the things that we can talk about, because, you know, we wanted to make this a two-part series, because I know that we're not going to get a lot of these questions answered just today, but there is a lot of things that we can do, and there's some things that we are working on. But like you said, we got to start at the local level. We got to start basically taking care of what's going on in our home, educating our teenagers, educating our family members, talking about in regards to race and punishment, in regards to the racial perception of crime. And when you start talking about the support for these punitive policies, we got to start, like I said, educating individuals. And they also did what's called a shadow report to the United Nations on racial disparities in the United States in the criminal justice system, and the changing the racial dynamic between women that are incarcerated. One of the callers was asking you about a woman as far as being an attorney, but also women that are committing crimes and that are being arrested too. You know, you got these women lifers, you got, and then we got these reality shows when they're talking about snapped and, you know, all these different crimes that are being committed, and looking at some of these sentencing. Now, we have 24 minutes left on the show. Again, if you want to call in, you can give us a call at 516-387-1914. Now, I want to ask you, Randy, because, like I said, this is going to be a two-part series. When we started talking about sentencing and the guidelines, you indicated something in regards to individuals that are in gangs. A lot of times, individuals don't realize what it means to have a gang enhancement or a joint suspension, and things of that nature. So they get sentenced, and they don't think nothing of it. They think, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to worry about it, or I'm going back to my same old neighborhood. And when you go back to the same neighborhood, you might wind up doing the same old thing. What would you want the listeners to know when we start talking about the sentencing guidelines, whether it's fair or unfair, and how that works when individuals are being sentenced?
Sure. So, you know, this is actually pretty interesting. I have a couple of things I want to say. First of all, there was a really great article done years ago, and it was in Mother Jones, and basically they were talking about our approach to criminal justice, and they're talking about three strikes sentencing guidelines and, you know, how different states adopt different policies. And I believe that this was somewhere in Milwaukee, I'm not certain, but I believe it was, where there the courts were trying to do something where just about every crime that was deemed nonviolent, and this even included auto theft or carjacking, they were sentencing these people to serve their time in the halfway house. And why did they do this? Well, number one, the state as a whole was facing these budget issues, and so Milwaukee wanted to do its part by saying, you know what, we're gonna have you in a halfway house, and you have to go to work, you have to pay to be locked up here. So they were sending these folks out to work every day, making them pay their own way, making them participate in treatment programs. And what we saw was, one, the cost of, quote, incarceration or incarceration in this way was greatly reduced. And two, they saw that the rate of recidivism was greatly reduced. So you talked about Proposition 36. Proposition 36 was something akin to this program. Of course, that was just a treatment and probation for these offenders. And for a while, I remember Prop 36 was really hot, and I had a lot of clients that they would get Prop 36 two or three times. What was interesting to me is those clients who repeatedly got it were white. Then I would have clients that had Proposition 36 once, and after that the judge had a very heavy hand with them. Now, all of these folks had something in common, which was the drug addiction, drug use, but I saw a disparity in how it was subsequently applied. I saw a lot of white defendants being given multiple chances at Prop 36. So that's one thing that I think people aren't aware of. But the other thing that I think is really important is we have, I talked earlier about Proposition 57. It's not, that's not just sentencing reform as far as three strikes is concerned. Another huge part of Proposition 57 is that it looks to do, back in the 90s, we had Proposition 21. Proposition 21 is what allowed individuals in the state of California who were 14 or older to be sentenced as adults. And whether or not you were going to be charged as an adult, it used to be up to the judge. After the 90s, the prosecutor decided whether or not to charge 14 to 18-year-olds as adults. Proposition 57 also undoes that prosecutorial discretion, puts it back on the judges, and says, wait a minute, this kid's going to get a fitness hearing. So a fitness hearing is another opportunity for families to get involved, have the, your son's favorite teacher come and speak as a character witness, get those letters going again. This is another shot for us to intervene on our children's behalf, and it's all because of Prop 57, so that's some more good news. We also already talked about how Prop 57 makes it, it makes the three strikes a little bit more equitable, so we won't have these, you know, sort of minor crimes being subject to three strikes. Another thing that's a lot older than Prop 57, and I think this was in the 97, it was a case, Roper v. Simmons. It made it so that we can no longer impose death, because that's another thing that was in this ACLU study, was the rate at which people of color to have the death penalty sought when they commit bad crimes. We know they're bad crimes, but if you're black or brown, you're more likely to have the prosecutor go for the death penalty. Well, Roper v. Simmons took the death penalty off the table for minors when they commit crimes. So those are some of the more positive changes.
And that's a good thing, because when you start talking about, like you said, people that committed a crime when they was a youth and then have rehabilitated or changed their ways, and then they died for the crime that they committed. Now, I want to speak a little bit about Prop 36. And like I said, that's because I was around during that time, and even in the court system and from a healthcare perspective. One of the things, when you start talking about nonviolent drug offense, those were supposed to be the ones that were eligible for Prop 36. So when they found that they were not eligible for Prop 36, most of the time it was because they had something in their record. I remember, or in their, on their criminal history, I remember one time going to my supervisor, and a person had a had served time in prison for attempted murder. And I called my supervisor, and I said, I got a question. If I'm supposed to be working with nonviolent drug offenders, and this person served prison time for attempted murder, don't you think that's violent? But that person had went through the system. So some individuals, depending on when they committed the crime. Then there were those that were, you know, they would fall out of Prop 36 because they have, you know, failed so many times, and then they would be seeing if they're eligible for drug court. And then if not, they would try to find an alternative sentencing. But one of the things that I also found with that was that when individuals started paying for their own treatment, like you were talking about when they were living in sober living homes, or they did better because they were paying their way, and they felt they earned it. They took it more serious, because when they thought it was free, they didn't care. They didn't want to be there. They wouldn't stop using, and they abused the system, which they didn't understand. And I would tell clients when they come in, I've seen clients go from PC-1000 to Prop 36 to prison, all for using drugs. And they say, well, I can do whatever I want to do. It's a health and safety violation, and you got arrested under a penal code. So part of me doing my group is trying to educate them about the system. Now, getting back to the sentencing and unequal sentencing for blacks and whites, I'm looking at some information, and it indicates that decades of research have shown that the criminal court sentences black defendants more harshly than whites. but a striking new investigation of sentencing disparities by Florida have expanded on the understanding of this problem in two important ways. It exposed the fact that African-American defendants get more time behind bars, sometimes twice the prison term of whites with identical criminal histories, when they commit the same crime under identical circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It also shows how biases on the part of individual judges and prosecutors drive sentencing inequality, meaning it starts with them. The
mm-hmm.
Florida legislators have been wrestling with this issue for decades, and in the 80s, for example, it tried to change sentencing policies that varied widely from place to place by creating sentencing guidelines. Now, today, prosecutors assign defendant points based on seriousness of their crime, the circumstances of their arrest, and whether or not they've had prior convictions to determine the minimum sentence required by law. And that's what we as regular people don't understand, those three components when we start talking about being sentenced: the seriousness, the circumstances, and prior convictions.
Yep.
Now, in a fair system, Black and white defendants who score the same number of points under this formula would spend the same time behind bars in regards to what they found. But they said that judges sometimes disregard the guidelines, the sentencing Black defendants to longer prison terms in 60% of felony cases and 68% of serious first-degree crimes and 45% of burglaries. In one-third felony cases, the least serious and broadest class of felonies, white Florida judges sentenced Black defendants to 20% more time than white defendants. Now, that war on drugs, as we know, weighed a heavy part, but we're not only talking about the war on drugs, we're talking about robberies, we're talking about murder, we're talking about assault. There's a lot of different things that we have to take into consideration, because we always want to just say because they were a drug addict or they were trying to support their habit. But we didn't think about what if they're trying to support their family, or what if they're trying to pay for their education, or where is all these drugs and stuff coming from. So a lot of things, I want to say, Brandy, is really being exposed because individuals are just not taking it anymore. They're not, you know, they're not just sitting back and sitting in silence. But we have to learn how to make our voices be heard. Now, we have 13 minutes left on the show. Again, if you want to call in, you can call in at 516-387-1914. Now, Brandy, I have some information that I wanted to share, and it was kind of some of the most ridiculous court sentences. Now, we all have our things to be like, wow, I don't believe they did that, or how dare they do that little old woman. Now, I have this one case. I don't know if you heard about this. I don't even know where it's at. But there was the case that I read in Compton. It happened on Rosecrans at it was called Lutus Park. There were two African-American women that were fighting. One was 70, and I think the other one was 73. And they were complaining about the noise. Oh, girl, they got bad. They were complaining about the noise. So what happened was there was a cane involved. And the 73-year-old got up, where the 70-year-old was saying, I can't breathe. And that 73-year-old woman got charged with murder. And I think it was about a year or a year and a half ago. So I don't know. And she had no priors, no nothing. Now here she got to go to jail for murder because she done got into a fight at the park because somebody was too loud. I have another call on the line. Let's take this caller. Hi, this is Jeanette Abney. Welcome to Precious Predicaments Blog Talk Radio. May I help you?
Hi, I have. I just wanted to ask about tips for young Black men and advice and warnings you have for us.
That's actually that kind of goes with what you just you were just talking about, because you mentioned something about the these two older ladies. And I have some information here in front of me and just some notes I wrote down in preparing for this. I kind of went through and looked at some patterns as they relate to injustice with women and injustice with young Black men and injustice with young Latino men, and inequities in sentencing. And one of the things that I came across that was really surprising to me was that no matter what the crime is, statistically, if you are a white male, you're going to get a shorter sentence. So the first thing I would say to young black men is that once you get involved with the system, the odds are against you. Your chances of prevailing on appeal, I think the statistic is 1% of 1% for prevailing on appeal. And it's very hard. Your father called in. He's talking 25 years later trying to get something off of his record. So stay away. That's the number one piece of advice I would give to young black men. Also, and we're seeing this in the news more and more every day, the fact that you are young, black, and male means you're already suspicious. You've already done something. So when you get stopped and caught and you do have marijuana when you don't have a medical card or you're under the age of 21, or if you are driving with a suspended license, any little thing that you do can snowball for you very quickly. So that's another thing. You can't take anything lightly. You have to be a model citizen at all times. One of the things I would say.
I want to chime in on that, Brandy. I want to say the attitude. Attitude is very important because I have
some pretty good advice.
And I remember the first time my son got arrested, you know, and we kind of bailed him out, and I went and got a lawyer. And my son said that they took him in a separate room, and they arrested him for terrorist threats for saying something verbal to the baby's mother. And you know, they were charging him with all these charges and crimes. And I'm thinking, I can't let my son go to prison. My son is only 18 years old, and here he's been arrested, and he didn't want me to know. But my son said, he didn't tell me until later. They took him in a room and told my son to take a deal for 13 years in prison. My son said, I know good and well my mother did not pay all that money for me to get 13 years in prison. So, one, you want to cooperate. You don't want to escalate it and make it worse because sometimes you might not even make it to a jailhouse. They might kill you on the street.
Right.
So, your attitude is going to be very important. You don't have to lawyer up, but you do want to cooperate. And just remember their names and document, document, document. Because then you have something, you have more power.
That's real.
Because if you fight with them, you're not going to win. So that would be my suggestion. Even as a therapist, make sure that you don't add to the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, there's another thing that I wanted to – thank you. There's another thing I wanted to share about women. And this was a real surprise to me. Working with lifers and specifically female lifers, well, most of my clients are men. I think we have 33 prisons in the state, and only 2 women's prisons, so that tells you how much crime they commit, we commit. Women, most of our crimes are related to our significant others. It could be either battered wife syndrome, right? You hurt, kill, wound the person that's abused you in the past, or stealing for this person, committing some crime at their behest, or a situation where you have a significant other who is a little too aggressive with the kids. He picks up a charge, and the next thing you know, you get one too for going along with it, covering up. The prostitution. Most of my clients, most of my female clients commit the crimes that they commit out of, quote, love. That's a really, really big one. I was very surprised. You may have a man who will go out and do a robbery, but for women, usually it's because of the relationship, quote, relationship.
True. And you know what, Brandy? I want to add something to that, too, because there is a lot with relationship issues. But now, and especially even back in the 70s, when you think of Bonnie and Clyde and things of that nature, you did find this couple, this ride or die. But also mental health. There's a lot of individuals, especially women, that are committing crimes because they're mentally and chronically mentally ill. When you're talking about killing children, you talking about, you know, we don't have these going on, these things that we shooting up buildings and shooting, you know, but they're either crime of passion, drug-related, mental illnesses. Now, we have 5-6 minutes left in the show. I wanted to talk about the top 5 most ridiculous court sentences of all time as we're talking about justice for all. Now, sometimes the American justice system works, sometimes it don't. Too many times the court sentences, the punishment, do not fit the crime. The justice system will give long jail sentences to people and charge them with nonviolent crimes and let murderers off for time served. I don't know if you remember the incident that happened several years ago with Latasha Harding, was a 15-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. She was shot by the Korean grocery store clerk in an argument about milk. The owner in that store was sentenced to community services, probation, and a fine. The community was at an uproar. Now, the incident happened around the same time as the Rodney King beating and is credited to being one of the most contributing factors of the L.A. riot. People was hot. Then they had another one, James versus Taylor. Police found a small amount of crack in James V. Taylor's car that investigators described as it being unweighable. But somehow it was enough for a 15-year prison sentence in Missouri, where the courts make an enormous distinction between crack and powder cocaine. So in other words, you couldn't even measure how much crack he had, but he got 15 years. Then we had, and I'm going to let you talk on this one, Paris Hilton. Paris Hilton was caught with 0.8 grams of cocaine in Las Vegas. Despite an arrest record for drunk driving, she was sentenced to only community service. Why do you think Paris Hilton only got community service, Brandy? Was it because of her review line?
It could be. You know, her name preceded her into the courtroom. A lot of times, I truly believe, and my husband would disagree with me on this, but I think that people don't realize that they're being racist. They actually just think that that's the way the world works. I think people sometimes don't even set out to be discriminatory. But, hey, this kid, you remind me of my niece or nephew, and that's my experience and my worldview. And so I'm going to go a little easy on you. And everyone else, you want to throw the book at them. So part of the reason it's so important to have women and people of color in these positions, because everybody is somebody's nephew, right? So it's a matter of getting people that look like you in the position to make decisions that impact your life.
And you know what? And that's true, because people are being placed in positions for a reason nowadays. Now, there's another one, which was Oscar Grant. Now, BART officer, this person, was caught on a cell phone camera shooting and killing a 22-year-old Oscar Grant in the Bay Area subway station. The shooting occurred while Grant was on the floor with handcuffs. After a highly publicized trial, they found him guilty of involuntary manslaughter and sentenced to a few months after time served and was released earlier that year. Now, and we can go on to some of the things that are happening now today that are creating chaos, but we are going to follow up with a lot of this stuff next week, because I like the fact that people are calling. I like the fact that they're asking questions, and we're not getting into this, you know, this debate. We're keeping it civil, because when we talk about justice for all, that means that when someone commit a crime, everybody has a voice. Everybody needs to be heard. But we do need to have justice for all. It shouldn't be so skewed that it's like, I look at it like being a teacher and you grading on a bell curve, meaning none of you guys really pass. All of y'all will get an F when the C is the highest score of 40. But you don't drop the bar to 40. And if you got a 20, you get a B, you know. So in less than 60 seconds, Brandy, what is it that you want the listeners to know for Justice for All? Because we're going to be ending it soon. What do you want to tell the listeners in regards to Justice for All?
Well, I just want to say, as sad as it is, the color of your skin is very highly determinative in whether or not your charges will be brought, whether you'll be stopped, whether you'll even have police contact. You need to keep that in mind when you leave the house and do right. I know it may not be fair. Unfortunately, at this point in time, it's just too bad, and it's just no excuse. We just can't afford to risk it.
Thank you very much. Join me and Brandy Duvall next week as we're going to be talking about I Got Life. Because as she indicated, there are several family members that are, their loved ones have life sentences, and they don't know what to do. There are people that we know that have been innocent, and they say we're innocent until proven guilty, but we find that that's not happening. But we're going to be right. giving you guys some resources, some skills, to try to help you support your loved one, your family member, or your spouse that are serving life sentences here at Crisis Predicaments at Blog Talk Radio. And until next week, remember, you got this. And thank you, Brandy. How can they reach you if they want to reach you for legal services?
Sure. You can email me at brandy@attorneyduvall.com, B-R-A-N-D-I-E, at attorneyduvall.com.
Thank you, Brandy. Can't wait to follow up with you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Talk to you next week. Blog Talk Radio, Press Predicament. Goodbye.
Bye.